to us in connection to what they do and faith. So I'm very glad today to welcome Sir Jeremy Cook, who's a judge. He's going to be speaking to us at the end on does faith fly in the face of the evidence? So evidence is his bread and butter and something he'll be able to help us on. So without further ado, Jeremy, can I welcome you up? We may have slight trouble with mic face. If at any times our voices are dropping, just this, and we'll remember to speak up more than we are.
Can I take my jacket off?
I think so. We're amongst friends.
Okay.
Even David Cameron does that now. It's just seems to be a...
But he doesn't wear a tie.
Really?
No.
So thank you for coming. The first question to... Well, I should probably declare my hand that if I'm a little over-familiar with Jeremy, it's because we have met before.
Yes.
Jeremy is the only person in the world to whom I've asked the question, may I marry your daughter?
And I said yes.
So if that had gone
and she said yes. More important.
Just to put you at ease, that otherwise this would be quite an awkward interview. As it is, I think I'll be all right. So Jeremy, the first thing we need to get out of the way is that extraordinary tan. Where have you just come back from?
Ah, well, I've just had 4 weeks in Australia. Well-earned holiday.
Okay. And, as I understand it, you've just caught the holiday bug, so a bit more to come, is there?
Well, yes, I mean, you come back for a week and you have to go away again, don't you? So I'm off to Africa for a couple of weeks starting Sunday, but that's... Yeah.
Well, thank you for filling us in the middle of it all. You're a judge, a high court judge, not an X Factor judge, so you're still waiting.
I live in hope.
But you've got on the bottom rung, so well done. And you've been involved in some pretty interesting cases. The reason you've been given this time off now is you've just come off a very big case. I think the biggest ever claim in a commercial court, $8 billion, where one company was going against Deutsche Bank and saying they wanted $8 billion from them. And that, I've had a similar situation myself where two children were fighting over a toy. What's it like when you scale it up to $8 billion? How do you find it?
Well, it's not the amount of money that's involved. It's the fact that in your case, you presumably had simply two children in front of you arguing the case. I had about five counsel on each side, plus magic circle firms behind them. So it was they were very big teams, all thinking of more and more arguments. Some of which were less good than others. But yeah, very hard work. 3.5 months of actual hearing time and then about 6 to 7 weeks of writing the judgment.
Okay. And you've been involved in some other pretty high profile cases quite recently. There was the Pakistani match fixing.
Yeah, I thought that's what this was about. It's the umpire, isn't it?
I didn't really explain that. The one thing in common is they're pointing up to God, but a lot of people are perplexed by that. Yeah,
How's that?
So I guess every schoolboy's dream is, going to work and watching cricket clips all day long. Is that what it was?
Not all day, but we had to watch the no balls time and again. We had a jury who didn't know the first thing about cricket. There wasn't anybody on the jury whose eyes lit up when they were told this was a trial about cricket, much to my surprise. Terrible waste, wasn't it? But I decided I'd hear this trial myself. I thought if any judge has got to hear a trial about cricket, well, I'll take the hit, yes, absolutely. So it was, it was a very straightforward trial, in truth, but we did have to watch cricket. We didn't have a site visit.
Okay, you pushed for that. immediately before that was a stabbing of the MP, Stephen Timms. He was stabbed by a woman in the name of Allah.
Yes, not far from here.
And pretty high-octane case. So when you made your judgment, there were cries of curse the judge in the gallery. And I understand there had been effigies burnt of you in more than one country. So it was quite a difficult case to try in that sense.
Well, the case wasn't difficult to try because she refused to recognise the jurisdiction of the court. So she was present from prison on video. And it was just a question of proving the case against her, which was straightforward because she'd walked into an MP's surgery and walked up to him and stabbed him in the stomach and been hauled off by the MP's secretary and so on. But the MP himself was a Christian man. and you may have read about this, I don't know, but he was a very gracious Christian man and you know, exhibited forgiveness and so on and so forth. That was well spent. He's a man I've met since. But,
and in your judgment, you contrasted the faith.
Well, it's, you know, the Christian approach is you must love the foreigner in the country. You know, we're told that very specifically. Love your enemy, and so on. And he was a man who showed all of that. So that was impressive, I thought.
Yeah, thank you. And I guess not many of us in our day-to-day lives face that kind of pressure or hostility. How do you find that? How does your faith impact that?
Well, it's part of the territory. I mean, everybody here who's doing a responsible job faces pressure, don't you? I mean, of one kind or another. And my job involves being taken up with making decisions and jury decisions that obviously have very serious repercussions for some people. And if you sentence people to life terms of imprisonment or very long periods of imprisonment, this is not likely to make you the world's most popular guy with their families and the like, or indeed with gangsters who are associated with them. But that goes for the territory. And I believe what I'm doing is doing what God has put me in this place to do. I try to serve him and do the job to the best of my ability.
And you are a convinced Christian. You became, I think, convinced in your teenage years.
Yes.
What was it that made the faith attractive or credible back in those days?
Well, I think the thing that influenced me more than anything else was simply seeing other people whose faith was obviously so real to them that it impacted on the way they lived. So these would have been people who were usually a few years older than I was, or young men who were leading in camps and other things that I was going on holidays for, and their faith was obviously the thing that drove them. And the thing that came across to me was very simply this: if Christianity is true, then it really is what you have to live by. Once I really grasped that, I realized that what life has to be about is serving God, being in the place he wants you to be, and following Jesus and making it real in your own life. You know, that's the driver, as far as I'm concerned, as it was so obviously for these other people. At that stage, I was convinced about it being true. The only question was, how does it impact on your life? Does it really matter? And it seems plain to me it plainly does.
Well, thank you. We're going to hear a little bit about why you think this is true and credible, and I want to leave time for that, so I'm going to hand over to you, and Jeremy's going to speak on does faith fly in the face of the evidence?
Thank you very much. Evidence. What is evidence? There was a famous but corrupt judge who asked the question, what is truth? Jesting Pilate, as he's referred to by Huxley. What is truth? Said Jesting Pilate, and would not stay for an answer. And of course, Pilate was faced, was he not, with a man who was accused of treason, who said in terms that he was a king, but not from this world, but from another place. You've got one of these blue forms, you can see it in John chapter 18. And one of the things that Jesus said in his conversation with Pilate, apart from saying that he truly was a king, but not the type of king that Pilate had in mind, was that he, Jesus, came to give evidence about the truth. If you see it in verse 37, the reason I was born and came into the world is to testify, to give evidence to the truth. And Jesus claimed to give evidence of ultimate truth with the authority of a king from another place, the ruler of all creation. And Pilate's stance, of course, was that of the cynic, namely that truth either couldn't be ascertained or that it really was unimportant it compared with real politique, the necessities of life so far as he was concerned, and in particular his position as governor of Judea. But of course, the whole process of law in which Pilate was ostensibly involved is based on the premise that truth is discoverable from what we call evidence. And Pilate recognized that that should have led to an acquittal of the man in front of him. But he ignores the evidence, and he brings in a conviction, and he seeks to limit his own responsibility for the fixed trial and the fixed verdict. He, with his skeptical approach, knew that evidence was important, knew that truth was actually discoverable, and that in this case the prisoner was innocent, but ignored it. And as that case shows, judges can get it wrong, can get it badly wrong. In the commercial court in London, we have quite a lot of lawyers who first qualified abroad before qualifying in this country. And I once had in front of me a reasonably young lawyer who'd been trained in the United States. And after he'd made his submissions, I gave one of my impeccably succinct and accurate rulings against him. And I could see he wasn't best pleased. He looked very aggravated, and he got up afterwards, and he said, "What would happen if I called you a demented, degenerate, stupid old fool?" Well, I thought I'd better nip this in the bud. So I said to him, "Well, that would be a disciplinary offence, and you could be suspended by the Bar Disciplinary Board, or struck off. Alternatively, I could commit you for contempt and send you to prison." So he looks at me, and he thinks. He said, "And what would happen if I only thought it?" And I made the obvious point. I said, "Well, there's nothing I can do about that. You can think what you like." So he looked me in the eye, and he said, "Let the record show that I think that you are..." We decide cases according to the evidence. It's the evidence that's important. And I have a little form of words that I always say to juries when I sum up cases for them. And I tell them they mustn't investigate matters on the internet, they mustn't look at newspaper reports, they mustn't look at any extraneous matter, talk to their families about the case and so on. They must discard everything from their minds save for the evidence that they hear in court. It's the evidence and only the evidence that matters. You must set aside all your preconceptions and decide the case on the evidence and come to common sense conclusions about the evidence you accept as being reliable and base your decision on it. And that's true for judges, and it's true for juries, and it's actually true in relation to all the big decisions that you take in life. It's surely the right test to apply. And it's in particular the test to apply to the big questions of life, the ultimate concerns of life with which Jesus himself was concerned, and Jesus' own claim that he answered them, that he testified to the truth. Now, evidence takes essentially two forms. The direct evidence of people who testify to what they have seen and heard or done. And then hearsay evidence, which appears in documents or what people say others have said to them about what they have seen, heard, or done. And we have various rules about admissibility in the United Kingdom in dealing with that, but the basic modern approach is a common sense approach. What is the comparative reliability of the evidence in the form that it takes? And what's true for judges and juries is also true for historians, isn't it? The basis upon which an historian reaches a conclusion and writes his book or paper about what's happened is the evidence that he finds in the shape of what people have said about what happened, and in particular what was recorded by them at or about the time in question. And they give appropriate weight to the various factors which may affect the reliability of that evidence. Do they have a particular axe to grind? Is there some potential bias? Are they seeking to exculpate themselves, justify themselves, put forward propaganda for the current people in power? Are they reliable in character? What's the degree of care that they've adopted in making the records in question? And all those factors are put into the melting pot and determine the weight to be given to any given piece of evidence. And then findings are made by the historian based upon what he finds to be reliable. Now, there are many different theories of evidence, and I took rather too long in the last talk that I gave telling a few jokes about these various theories. But, of course, in the round, the position is very simple. You look at all the evidence, and you weigh it up. You evaluate it. You sift it to see what's important and what is unimportant. You're looking for the most probative evidence and the most cogent explanation that fits that evidence that you accept. And usually, in my experience, and as a commercial judge, I make the decisions of fact in civil cases. Once the issues are clarified and one is able to see the wood from the trees, usually the evidence points pretty clearly in one direction or another. And those of you who are lawyers will know that in a civil trial, the test is the balance of probabilities. What is more likely than not? Whereas in a criminal trial, the jury has to be sure, beyond reasonable doubt, as we used to say, that a defendant is guilty before they can convict him. But that's how the search for truth is conducted. And actually, it's how you operate, when you stop to think about it, every day in relation to issues which arise in business or elsewhere, do you not? I mean, what rational basis is there for doing anything different? And when the issue is very difficult, what you don't do in real life is throw your hands up in horror and say, I can't make a decision. Because in fact, not making a decision is often actually making a decision. It's deciding to do nothing. You can't opt out. You evaluate the evidence and you come to some conclusion or another. And so decisions are made in every area of life, based usually upon what others have told you, evidence, and your experience of them and of the world. Well, that's a quick look at evidence. Let's turn to faith. What's faith? Well, faith is what you believe to be the truth. It's often distinguished from knowledge, but that distinction is not as sharp as is often made out. Because most of the knowledge that you have is actually based upon what others have told you. Just think about it. It's self-evident. Parents, that's the first place you got some knowledge of. School teachers, university lecturers, authors of books, business people, Wikipedia, whatever. That's where most of your, quote, knowledge comes from. What other people have said. Evidence of a kind. And knowledge is often used, is it not, to refer to something of which you're more certain than faith. I know, you say, or I believe. One is looked at as being weaker than the other. But they're not polar opposites, are they? Because evidence applies to each. Scientism would have us believe that knowledge is only possible if something can be experimentally repeated and measured. But that's absurd. We all know there are huge areas of knowledge which are not capable of being repeated in a laboratory experiment. And all experimentation does is to confirm a hypothesis or a theory, which is sometimes later falsified by further experiments. And then we use faith in another context. Because I may say that I trust Andrew. I have faith in Andrew. Make a mistake, it may not be. But you trust someone, and it's usually based, again, on what other people have told you about them and your experience. That most business is really based on trusting the other person on the other side of the deal. If you didn't trust them, you wouldn't deal with them at all, I guess. Unless you have extremely good lawyers who will tie the whole thing up for you. But then someone is often described as having a faith. And what people mean by that is a worldview of some kind. A worldview. But of course, everybody has a worldview, like it or not. Whether it's thought out, whether it is muddled or whether it's actually unconscious. Because it's what we actually believe about who we are, what we're about, what the significance of life is, what we value, what's important, what's wrong, and what the solutions are to the problems we see around us. The ultimate questions of human life and death. And everybody has a way of looking at reality and evaluating it, sifting out what they think is important from what they think is insignificant. Even if there is, and there often is, inconsistency in the approach, in the aims, and in the actions that are adopted. But right now, in 21st century Britain, the worldview, I think, is particularly muddled with professed agnosticism or uncertainty about the ultimate issues as the norm. And I'd like to suggest that saying, I don't know, or I have no faith, is actually a nonsense. Because, like it or not, everybody lives out a worldview of some kind. It affects what we think is important and what we think is unimportant affects the way we live. To say I don't know and do nothing is to say I believe those issues don't ultimately matter very much at all. Whether that's thought through consciously or not. But it is irrational, isn't it, for a person not to think through their worldview and come to a conclusion based on the most cogent evidence that makes sense of what we know to be the case round about us. A universe in which we live, which works rationally according to what we like to call laws of science. If it's all chance, then why do things work in an entirely rational and ordered manner? How does humanity, with its personality and its rational capacity, exist if it's all, again, a product of chance? How can humans love and be capable of altruistic action? How can humans, on the other hand, be malicious and cruel and exceedingly selfish? How is it that we look for truth and meaning at all? Why do we think in terms of justice and right and wrong? The most instinctive attitude of the child is to say, it's not fair. Justice is something that's inbuilt in all of us. How does that come about? And religion that's found in every society of some kind. And a sensible worldview has got to take account of all these elements so as to provide the most cogent explanation for them. And your worldview, your faith, is irrational and illogical if it doesn't. And what I'd suggest to you is this, that the Christian faith is not the opponent of rationality and actually provides the most logically coherent and cogent explanation for those features that I've mentioned. And above all, for Jesus, who referred to himself as giving evidence of ultimate truth on those issues because of who he was. And that's why I invite you to think that's the big question to be answered in coming to worldview turns on Jesus and the evidence about him. The evidence he gave and the evidence about him. And faith in Jesus is an entirely rational response if he is who he claimed to be. And if the evidence supports him and trusting what he says is the only logical thing to do. If he knows what he's talking about, then we had better take notice, had we not. Now, the evidence for Jesus is to be found essentially in the records made of his life, teaching and death, and resurrection of ascension. It's there for you in the New Testament records. And the question is, what conclusion should you reach on that evidence about him, the significance of who he was, what he said, and what he did? I could go on for some time about the evidential weight to be given to the New Testament. I haven't got time to do that, but in terms of manuscript evidence, you can be very confident that the records that you now have on your iPhone, on your iPad, in the Bibles here, reflect the writings of those who were around at the time of Jesus and knew him. The problem, in truth, is not one of evidence. The evidence of his high moral teaching is there, and very few people doubt it. You find people quoting Jesus' ethical teaching, the highest ethical teaching known to man, and people recognize that is something he undoubtedly taught. His consistency of character is recognized in the light of that teaching, and the inability of other people to fault him is absolutely remarkable. But what caused his death then, and what causes people to jib now about Christianity, is the remarkable claims that he made about himself, about who he was, what he came to do, and the need for individuals to respond to him as the key to life. And the New Testament shows the reluctance of those who knew him best to come to the conclusion that they should put their trust in him. They did so belatedly and reluctantly. But what persuaded them at the end of the day was his resurrection. He did things that they never expected God to do. But when he rose from the dead, they were suddenly presented with something out of all their experience that they recognized was truly only explicable if he was who he said he was. Tomorrow I'm going elsewhere. I'm now going to speak on the evidence for the resurrection in the gospel stories. To my mind, it's very cogent and powerful and compelling evidence indeed, and I invite you to look at it for yourself. Many who've done so have become Christians simply on the strength of it. There are plenty of books around on the subject which Andrew can recommend to you if you're interested. But Jesus himself knew that there were many people who would not be persuaded even by that. And I can say that because of a story that he told, with which probably most of you are familiar. It was a story he told about a very rich man who lived in a mansion. He dressed in the most expensive, opulent, and fashionable attire of his time. And we know that he lived in luxury because his house is described as having a front gate. And if you think of houses in Jerusalem, every house fronted the street in the ordinary way. You'd have to be a very wealthy man to have a front gate with a driveway and parkland. You can imagine it in today's terms, can you not? The huge gatehouse and the mansion and the acres and so on. This was a wealthy man. And in his gatehouse, in the shadow of the gate, every day a beggar would come. And he would lie there and beg, seeking help. And the mansion owner would see him every day, but did nothing whatsoever about him. And Lazarus, as this beggar's called in the story, is plagued by the scavenging dogs and can't even fend them off. And life continues with this contrast in these two men's positions. And from what emerges later in the story, what we find is that Lazarus has a right relationship with God, and the house owner, the mansion owner, does not. This man is caught up totally in his own living, without any reference to God or what God requires. And the story, Jesus tells, has these two men in contrasting positions after death. The beggar is described as sitting next to Abraham, Abraham's best mate, if you like, whilst the mansion owner is described as being in Hades in agony, and asking Abraham to send Lazarus down to give him a cooling drink of water. Because he still seems to think that his status in life requires Lazarus to fit in with him. He's had no regard for God or others in his life. And the answer that Abraham gives is, no can do. You can't go from one location to the other. And the mansion owner says, and it's the first thing that does him credit in the story, he says, I've got five brothers. Will you please send Lazarus to warn them so they don't make the mistake that I did? And at that, Abraham says, what would be the point? They've got the records of what God has done for his people in the Old Testament, the law and the prophets. They know what God requires, which is that people should turn to him and ask for his mercy and grace and forgiveness and seek to live out their lives for him in dependence on him. And the rich man replies, no, he says, no. If someone should go to them return from the dead, it would make all the difference. They'd think again. They would repent, which is what the word means. And Abraham says in the story, if they don't listen to what Moses and the prophets have to say, they won't be convinced even if someone should return from the dead. Jesus' story is very simply aimed at those who will not consider the evidence of what God has done. As recorded for them in the Old Testament, as recorded for us in the New Testament, what Jesus has done. And he makes the point expressly that even if he should rise from the dead, some people will never change their worldview. Some people will not examine the evidence for faith. Now, I haven't got a hope of persuading you in 25 minutes of the strength of the evidence, either in favour of the resurrection of Jesus or of the Christian worldview as put forward by Jesus. But what I can say to you is this: the evidence is there for you to investigate. Judge for yourself. Many have done it before you. Many have gone through various courses, have read the New Testament themselves and been convinced. And starting here, as I understand it, on Monday, there's yet another course, Christianity Explored, which does exactly that, looks at the evidence for you to come to your own view about whether Jesus is who he said he was and whether his evidence was reliable and what you should do about it. Now, if you want to ask me any questions, I'm more than happy to help in any way that I can, and I'm sure Andrew would likewise. But if you look in the New Testament and look at the evidence for Jesus, you can encounter him. You can meet with the risen Jesus on the pages of the New Testament and see his evidence. And I can't recommend strongly enough that that's something you should do. Thanks.
Thank you, Jeremy. Jeremy mentioned this course. There's details on the sheet running over 4 Monday lunchtime, looking at the New Testament documents. Please, if you're interested in that, just tick the box and leave these sheets on the steps as you leave them in the box.